Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper on March 3rd, 2024.
Happy birthday, honey.
Thank you. Thank you. We're in Richmond for the annual birthday trip, Richmond, Virginia. And joining us today are
Cynthia Gompert,
Ellie Burke,
and
say it again,
David Gompert.
David Gompert from New Hampshire. So he's going to be, you know, it's going to the audit. It's going to be a little bit of a mixed delivery from David, both in content and in auditory quality, because he's from New Hampshire. But we'll do the best we can. Right. But we don't want to miss David as part of the annual Gompert podcast. A lot of people love the Gompert podcast, and the people who hate it don't say anything to us. So we're going with it. Right. Is that fair?
Right. That's okay. Fair.
All
right.
All right, he's back. All right. So go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, so we've been here a couple of days, and we did, you know, we've had some little adventures, right? We went to the Museum of History and Culture with Cindy, and that was fun. It was a little bit like, the way I describe it is being in somebody's attic, but there are labels on everything.
That's fair.
So there are all these kind of objects, right. Yeah. You know, some of them are more historical than others, you know, a whole wagon. You know,
Conestoga wagon,
bits of
covered wagon,
old forks, yeah. You know, various ephemera, people's shoes,
trash,
yeah, and a little bit of art too.
Right.
So we did that, and we have also been going to restaurants, which we do like to go to Pearly's. We like to, which is basically a Jewish deli.
Yeah,
kind of place.
I would say Jewish style deli, but the truth is, you got to give them their props. It's real food. I mean, so it's cool,
right? Yeah. It's decent.
Yeah.
Where else have we been? We've been to Metzger's Bar and Butchery.
Mm-hmm. How was that?
Is the name.
It was good.
It was good. Nice. It's a very it's a grown up atmosphere. Again, it's dark and glimmery. Okay. And the food was quite.
It was good. There was one disappointment. They had a chicken dish there, but it wasn't the same one that you may remember from last year, David. A chicken dish that was so good that after we finished eating, David, who I just think had two drinks, was standing outside the restaurant and accosting people who were lined up to go in, saying, "Order the chicken."
Yeah.
And I'm not making this up.
No, you know what? We were there recently, and I agree with you. Categorically.
Thank you. All right. So go ahead.
you know, it's always fun to come down here and see different restaurants. And we really do try to go places that are not available on the turnpike. So it's been good. And, you know, speaking of restaurants, I still feel we're in recovery from the pandemic in terms of getting the food up to snuff and the service up to snuff. And there was an article in the New York Times this past week talking to chef owners and saying, you know, what's going on? How do you feel? How's your business? What are the problems? You know, and what did they say, Dan?
Well, the article called 30 Chefs Unfiltered, and it was snippets of various interviews.
Chefs from all over the country.
All over the country.
But largely small operations.
Well, I think you said it right. Owner-operated.
Yeah.
Not changed. And they're unhappy. At least the ones they talked to. They were basically venting about the pushback they're getting from customers with respect to prices, their conflicts about having a model based on tipping, their inability to get the right price point on their foods, and therefore, you know, develop what they think is a sustainable living. They're unhappy, and their principal, you know, principal object of their unhappiness is the customers, which is a problem because they're kind of dependent on the customers. But there clearly is a disconnect between what these chefs, at least, want to do and think they ought to be getting paid for doing, and the attitude of the people in their restaurant.
Well, there's still a big problem with hiring.
Yes,
they do mention that.
Yeah,
I mean, one chef says specifically, "I hire anybody who can walk, anybody who walks in, right. I will hire."
Right.
And, you know, the problems with that. And I mean, what are you experiencing down here in terms of restaurants? Do you see a big difference since? pandemic?
Well, I've noticed that the restaurants that seem to be doing well are small chef owner operated, but they really have focused on their staff and keeping the staff.
Right.
So they're maybe paying them a bit better. They're trying to give them benefits. I'm thinking of like Grisette, for example.
Yeah.
They've really grown that. But again, it's a smaller restaurant and their clientele also doesn't really argue with their pricing.
Mm-hmm.
They are very clear on they're trying to be as sustainable as possible, so they get local ingredients. So there's sort of a clear, when you walk in, you know what you're paying for.
So have they, the restaurant you have in mind, mm-hmm. Do they abandon tipping or do they still have tipping?
They still have tipping.
Okay, because one of the, everything that sounds good to you.
I've abandoned tipping.
Yeah, we know that abandon is a kind word. You're putting a shine on it. But my point, Elliot, is the kind of restaurant you describe is consistent with the restaurants that I think are the subject of this article, several at least. And their owners were often saying, I wish we didn't have a tipping model. The tipping model seems, in their view, the restaurant owners, somewhat antithetical to the notion about having a steady compensation scheme, having the kind of benefits you're talking about. There seems to be a conflict there.
Yeah.
But
so are they building it into like a service fee? So it's across the board?
It's odd because they're saying the model, the tipping model doesn't work from their perspective. But they're not changing it. They're grousing about it. I don't know how they expect.
Well, there are different ways to do it. You could have a service fee, or you could just raise all the prices.
Well,
another 20% or whatever.
I think,
and that's what this article seems to say, that a lot of people are complaining about prices.
Right. So they feel they can't do it. They can't put on the service fee, and they can't raise the prices, and yet they wish they weren't stuck in this tipping loop.
Because
I think one of the issues is that there are a lot of people that whine in this country, and I think that they're not cognizant of the fact that food prices have gone up.
Yeah.
And restaurants can't make very much, and the people grouse about it. But whining's the thing.
Yeah. I don't even think it's food. I think it's service. I think labor costs are just skyrocketing.
About Richmond, which is a food mecca on a small scale. But the best restaurants in Richmond, Grisette, Alewife, Metzger, Roland's, they are owner-operated, family-owned, not much fuss about tipping. Menus are not out of control. Simple menus, exceptional food. And, it's the right formula, which makes us happy that we live in Richmond.
Yeah, well, that's good. But it's a formula that apparently these chefs, at least in the article, find
elusive.
Well,
here's one thing. You count on getting a certain amount of money out of each table each time you turn a table.
Right.
And they were complaining that you can't have a restaurant without having a burger. A burger's going to cost...
It's got to be on the menu.
The most you can charge is like $19.
Right.
Okay. And your other average prices may be in the 30s or the,
Yeah.
And so the more that, people order the burger, the more they're losing out.
Right.
On their, if too many people order the burger, they're not covering the nut that you need to cover. And here's the problem. We do that. We buy the burger. There's nothing I like better than a really good burger with a really nice glass of wine.
Yes.
Now, if you go to a burger joint, they have red, white, or, rosé, and it's not very nice.
Yeah.
So
I also think that this is an interesting point, because I was just saying to someone the other day, I feel like we have a bit of a gap in the place where there are these really delicious restaurants. They're sourcing things locally, but it is a higher price point. Maybe not super high, but it's higher. And then there's this in between where there's not this, we're not trying to spend $150 for a family. We're trying to maybe spend $80 for a family.
Right.
It's a little bit more in the middle. There's nothing really that exists in there. And then you have fast food.
Well, I think that's why we're running into the higher prices, the higher food costs.
And if you're a chef owner, you're going to be doing more of that other end.
Right. But so this article is on fancy restaurant. Right.
But the chefs quoted here say, You can't cover your costs in a medium price restaurant.
Well, they might be right.
You can't give people in health insurance, et cetera.
Right.
Unless your
revenue is from selling
Well, it depends on the restaurant, obviously. And a lot of these restaurants don't have liquor licenses. Some do, some don't, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Because the ones that we mentioned do a lot of revenue on drinks before, during, and after the meal.
Yeah, but...
No, that's great. But that's where they make their money. Up in Jersey, for instance, there's a lot of BYOB, which people love. They can bring their... I don't really want to bring my own bottle because I'm drinking 1.5 glasses of wine and Dan's drinking a beer. And so, you know, I either have to, you know, take home most of the wine or, you know, leftover wine is not the greatest.
So. Yeah, but there's a lot of BYOB in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
But I think we've touched on all the reasons that it's challenging. And as Ellie said, you know, higher food costs, higher labor costs, we're all saying. And you put it all together, you're going to have some real tension between what people hope and expect to get from their restaurant experience and what they're being required to pay. And I think everyone's feeling that. So there's some unhappiness on both sides.
The market is segmented. The people in Richmond who go to the restaurants that we mentioned can certainly afford it. They think nothing about shelling out $150 for 200 people.
Yeah.
And there's a big drop between that strata and the other folks who, as Ellie points out, really have nowhere to go because they can't afford it.
Well, yeah, but sometimes you can afford it, but you're not out to do afford that it, every time.
All right.
Anyway, we got to move on because, all right, so one of the things that we were here, David, Cindy showed us the book that your friends made of Moose Pond, house that you recently sold in Maine. And Dan came up with an interesting article about Maine education.
Yes, Maine education, which we showed to Ellie. Ellie, why don't you just...
So this was an interesting article about a town in Maine that is already experiencing and also forecasting a decline in the lobster trade in their town, that it heavily relies upon that as a industry, and that people who stay in this town and continue to live there would go into that as a trade, and they're seeing it decline. And so they decided to try to reintegrate some more trade school options for skill building and different trades. And they found out that it was not allowed, apparently. I was actually curious about why it was. They don't go into that, but there was a rule. It says the rules of the regional school district wouldn't allow for it. So this town in 2014 voted to break free and create their own district so that they could actually include basically shop classes. And this whole article is talking about how beneficial and great that's been for the town. And I think that's interesting for this small town in Maine, but I think it's really indicative of, it's making me think a lot about also, even this a separate topic, but how more students now are choosing maybe not to go to four-year colleges because because they're like, what am I going to get out of this amount of money I'm putting in? And I also think that we're seeing this across the board. There's been less and less tradespeople. There are trades that need people, not just even in the traditional ones, but I was listening to something the other day talking about no one knows how to work on electrical vehicles. They need a whole slew of people who can work on electric vehicles and they don't have them. So I thought it was an interesting perspective kind of on the broader.
That started when it was, you know, saying you have to go to college.
Right.
And people didn't want to do that. They needed the trades, but the educational systems stopped doing that. So now they're doing a turnaround. What came first?
Well, you know, it's a couple of different things. There's the vocational aspect, which you're talking about.
Yeah.
But there's also the life skills aspect. You know, everybody, you know, there was a thought that you need to know how to do some basic things to get through life, whether it's... you know, electrical connections or, you know, gluing pieces of wood together. And my brother's made a bunch of interesting things. David, did you have shop when you were in high school?
Yes.
And you have any thoughts about whether it should still exist?
I have thoughts about what Ellie said.
All right. But in the high school that we went to, they actually had car mechanics. They had a car shop.
Yeah. Really?
Yes.
That's interesting.
Fantastic.
My high school had that.
Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
The model that Ellie described as desirable is, in fact, the European model.
Yeah.
But built into the structure of European education because they don't want to go to a four-year college. They have trade school built in as a matter of culture and economically.
But it's also built in terms of what the society values and shows that they value.
Exactly. Now, Maine is kind of a special case. The principal industry in Maine is the yard sale. Maine has great difficulty building an economy of any sort, really. Right. You don't go through Maine to get anywhere. The agriculture is not favorable. All the rich people live on the water, and everybody else is less rich. So Maine has a real serious problem in finding a way to make use of its people, of its talent. And I think this is exactly the way to do it.
Well, it's just too bad that these people had to form their own school district and withdraw from the broader school district they were in because they were actively being opposed by the broader Maine school district who felt that these...
I don't think there is a Maine school district. I think it's even that there. It's a local school district.
I'm not sure what that means, but...
it's American education, public education.
Yeah,
it's a local control, which isn't necessarily very flexible or creative.
It's not state. It's
I understand
local.
That. No, I understand. But they withdrew that. There was a township school district, and they withdrew from that school district. Who was
yes,
strong negative.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on again because I think this is interesting. But let's go to the next one, which is I want to get to Cindy. Cindy being our expert in terms of the article on greeting cards, and they're not singling you out because of age. If anything, Cindy. You're not the birthday girl today, Tamsin, but there's an article about the idea.
There's an article that some people are wanting to get rid of the ageist zingers humor in greeting cards. And they're finding it just that it's offensive. People don't like it, et cetera, so on and so forth.
They don't get it.
I think they get it.
Yeah. But my feeling is that some people really get a kick out of these cards, particularly like me. And I think that people just need to have a little bit of humor. So maybe when you're picking a card, you need to figure out who you're sending it to.
But if it's snarky remarks about how old you're getting,
yeah,
I think a lot of people don't like that.
Well,
I'm not looking for that.
No, but you're... What I'm saying, you need to know who you're sending the card
to. Yeah, look, I think there's funny and there's not funny. There's always going to be that. But I think one of the things the article said, it ended when someone says, I don't see this as a problem. I just send my relatives greeting cards about fishing. And I'm saying to myself, that's cool because it's not a matter of being snarky or not snarky, but no matter what age you are, you like to be seen for who you are, not how old you are. Not that it's not about negative or positive, but you don't want to be seen as headline, you're that old person.
Yeah.
I'll
tell you about a card that Cindy got from her sister some time ago.
Yeah.
And two elderly ladies, one said to the other, I really like this assisted living.
Yeah.
They get me up.
No, David.
They get me out of bed. I get breakfast. I have a bowel movement. And the other one says, that's somewhat like mine. Wake up, I have a bowel movement, they get bed, they feed me breakfast.
All right.
Did you get that one?
No, we haven't gotten it. Yeah. All right. So I don't want that card. I don't know if you're making a great case for the card. But okay. So
you're saying that they zero in only on age and making a joke about age versus any other aspect of them.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You just don't want to be seen that way that's what you are. You're that old person.
Yeah, it's just about your age.
Yeah, it's not about you. And the best kind of card is something that says something about you because the person sees you.
Yeah.
You want to be seen and you want to be recognized on your birthday in that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to make too big a point of it, but I think there is that element in greeting cards, right?
Yeah.
So that's all I think.
Well, there are two kinds of cards, the age cards and the fart cards.
Yeah. Well, those are related, Kent, and I don't want to burst your ball on that, but they're in the same category. All right. So here's your chance, David. You wanted to say something about women's athletics. You were mentioning the University of South Carolina basketball team.
Yes, I do.
Go ahead.
The content of the article in the Times about the University of South Carolina Gamecocks women's basketball team is interesting. They've added a few players, and now they have just extraordinary team on offense and defense, and it's all jelly. But that got me thinking. A week ago or 2 weeks ago, Cindy and I went up to Washington to watch her granddaughter, Audrey, participate in a colossal volleyball tournament. It's a work of art to see volleyball played the way it should be. Girls who range from, I guess, 12 to 18. And I asked several people, is men's volleyball as interesting? Is it as much, is it as exciting? And the answer was, not really. Because with men's volleyball, it comes over, they prop it up, and wham. Yep. And that's it. Pretty much it. Women's, they just move it around delicately, and finally go, not so much for the kill, but just for the finesse. I mentioned before the podcast began that our son discovered there was a huge difference between teenage women's girls' soccer and boys, in that the former was highly team-oriented, and the latter was more oriented than it should be about who was the best player on the team. Now, all of this, including this article at the University of South Carolina, got me thinking, since Title X, which I think was 72, women's sports have gotten
better.
Title IX. Better. Just how good can they be? And I'm not thinking only relative to men's sports, but, you know, that's where you sort of end up. What is the big differences? Women getting taller, getting faster, getting stronger. They're certainly focused, certainly at the high school and the college level. I won't comment on WNBA, but all of these things suggest that women have some distance to go yet in realizing their full potential based on speed, strength, eye, hand, and so on. Not only in basketball, but also in volleyball and probably soccer and some other sports. They may not be as fast. Well, they're not as fast. They're not as big. They're not as strong as men. My question is, does this teamwork factor powerful when they're younger, including in volleyball and soccer, does that still operate when you get into the college ranks? Not to mention the professional way. I think just anecdotally, it sort of does. If you read this article, it talks about how this person has added a certain ingredient and how the others have sort of rallied around that idea and it's made them better. The increase in the number of assists is quite impressive. Not because all players are of the same caliber, but because the rest of the team has adjusted to the best passers, the best shooters. And that seemed to me to reinforce this idea that even for the top team in the country, college team in the country, teamwork counts. Now, men's teamwork, I don't know. I mean, who's on the Lakers beside LeBron? Dan can probably name one or two.
I can name seven, but I see what you're saying. But David, here's what I would say, because we're going to have to move on a little bit. And I don't disagree with you entirely. And I will tell you from my own experience, I would just put it a little differently. I'm coaching kids who are middle school and high school, both girls and boys. I wouldn't say so much teamwork. Or I would say that for the girls, the sports were more of a social experience than it was for the boy.
Amen.
And in fact, and to be successful, I thought, in teaching girls, you had to be mindful of that. You had to make sure they had that social experience. You needed to have breaks or whatever where they got a chance to talk to each other.
Right. Move on.
Yeah. So, but I do think that there is a tension between getting to the higher levels of athleticism and what you're calling teamwork. Because I think once you get to higher levels of athleticism and you have stars and you have superstars who can dominate, you know, not dependent on the other players, you're going to see more of what I think you would identify as more individualistic play. So, for example, the team that won the championship last year for women's college sports was LSU. The star of the team is Angel Reese. Right now, Angel Reese has been on and off that team this year, been kicked off or taking herself off, whatever. She's has a lot of tension with the coach. She sees herself as a star. She's getting supported by NILs. You're familiar with NIL. There can be private funding of particular college players. I'm not trying to single her out as being a bad person or anything like it, but that's the kind of situation let me finish the sentence with it. You would associate with more of the male superstar approach, right?
We got a couple jocks with this. I'm just wondering what they think.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Get the hook.
Okay. So does that mean you want to move on?
Yes.
That Cindy wants to move on.
I'd like to hear from Jason.
I can't say I have any expertise in the potential of women's sport.
Yeah, I mean, obviously,
I understand everything you're saying, but I also see you do see this development of stars in women's sports now, and we'll have to see how that plays into the teamwork aspect.
Move on.
All right. Well, I had an article here. I don't know if it's worth spending any time, but I'll just bring it up. This is men's sports, but this is an odd athletic regimen. There's a fellow who I wasn't familiar with, whose name is Nolan Schnuel, who plays for the Angels. He's a very young player who just started last year. And he got worn down in his first season in the major leagues. And he came up with an off-season workout regimen, which focused on spending 2 days of every week entirely on his feet. In other words, he's standing all day. And his theory was that he would strengthen his legs that way and give himself a certain amount of stamina just by virtue of being able to stand all day, 2 days every week. He found it exhausting. By the end of each of those 2 days, he was destroyed. And his early returns, and his early returns to spring training, is that he says, oh, yeah, I feel stronger. I feel my legs are stronger. I feel my legs are bigger. I think it's going to pay off. It's interesting to me just because no one told him to do this. It's not like there's any special athletic trainer who said, here's a plan. I've worked with other people. I think it'll work. And yet this is what this fella does for a living. So you don't want to be wrong about this because, you know, it's everything's in on athletics for him. And this is the way he went. So what do you guys think? You think that makes any sense?
I think that it would be curious to see if he thinks it is true for the rest of his season.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think, when I think of it, maybe that's a certain kind of endurance, but it's like not training. It's not really training your muscles in a different kind of way. Mm-hmm. But maybe if he's doing that additional training, then the standing, it's training some kind of endurance, because if he was exhausted at the end of it, there's something that's getting worked.
Well, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's going to be very good at waiting online to get in restaurants. And somewhere looking at art. He's training to stand.
Yeah.
Good for him.
He's serious. This is what he's probably doing other
this
stuff.
This goes back to the idea that something that's hard and uncomfortable and difficult, we think is going to be good for us,
right?
Regardless, you know.
But is it?
Is it?
You know? And in what way?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So we'll just see. So you guys can follow this year. Follow Nolan Schnuel. When you check
this. Baseball player. There is some standing around in baseball.
There's a lot of standing around baseball. Yeah. And people do talk about it. It's a long season. Yeah. All right. Let's move on to ice cream.
Just a brief note.
Yes.
Turns out chocolate chip ice cream is not so popular anymore. I mean, chocolate chip was like one of the early mix-ins, right? You had vanilla ice cream and chocolate, and so we all liked it. Now that they're mixing in all kinds of crazy, wonderful, exotic things, vanilla ice cream with a few little chocolate chips doesn't sound so exotic. And so there's a whole article about how, yes, indeed, in some places you can't even buy it in the grocery store. Wow. It's now a seasonal, occasional flavor, and maybe even limited to certain clientele, certain segments.
Did it say
of
which
the population?
Season?
Maybe the same.
In the summer, because in general they sell more ice cream, I guess, and only in certain places. And they sell, you know, they had this discussion about Babcock Dairy Plant. In the summer, you know, they sell, it took 4.5 months to sell through the 110 gallons of chocolate chip ice cream it made compared to 3 months, okay? 3 months for chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream. So anyway, sorry. And you know, they say, you know, again, people order more.
My point is, Ellie keeps saying she believes it.
I'm not surprised.
The rest of us are shocked.
Yeah, I know, but I'm wondering if this goes back to the greeting card situation.
Is it, you're going to relate this to bowel movements?
I'm just saying, those who are shocked, and those who aren't, there might be a
demographic here.
Yeah, demographic going on. But I also think it's kind of interesting that, like, vanilla hasn't gotten less popular, but that kind of makes sense.
No, they do say in the article vanilla's gotten less popular, really? Too. It hasn't had the same decline as chocolate chip, but vanilla's backed up, too.
Chocolate chips have different kinds of flavors.
Yeah.
As a former marketing executive, I can tell you, this is about supply, not demand.
What do you mean?
Bunch of guys sitting around saying, how can we do better than chocolate chip? I got it. We'll pump up expectations and interest in sort of seasonal changes. Not because people were demanding something other than chocolate chip, but they just fell for the market.
Wait a sec. Wait, let's give Ellie her due there. Ellie, seriously, and your kids too. Do your kids clamor for chocolate chip?
No, they don't. And I would say, actually, I would say maybe, and this isn't a negative, but I think who's responsible for this is Ben and Jerry. Because they invented chocolate chip cookie dough and Oreo. And you're going to get cookies and cream instead of chocolate chip.
That's progress.
That's just the beginning. A million. Yeah. But so I think I'm thinking that if you're going to want something in your ice cream, you're going to go for some kind of interesting new thing. And that you're not just going to go with the basic. But if you're going to go with the basic, you're just going to get a vanilla or a chocolate or a strawberry.
All right, look, it's just chocolate chip was the rage. I was the rage. I know it certainly wasn't the most popular. All right, so you're right.
Oh, just another little article that I noticed about Maine, and that is there's a big increase in the use of heat pumps in Maine heating lately. So heat pumps just extract heat out of the air, oddly enough, and it uses electricity to do that.
Yeah.
So it's not, you know, people are not having to burn oil and gas to get their heat. And there have been lots of incentives in Maine to invest in this. And they say it's, you know, people are very happy with it. It's a coming thing. And a lot of the power, apparently the electricity power in Maine is powered by wind. And other things, David, do you know anything about this?
Electricity? I know our electric bill went up threefold when we switched to heat pumps.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
They say people's electric bills are going down.
But when we worked there,
I was paying $350 a month for electricity to keep the heat pumps going at 40 degrees. But
I'm wondering if their overall utility bills have gone down versus their electric loans, because if they're not paying for oil or they're not paying for a different form of it.
Well, the article claims that the differential between the oil, that it still costs a lot during the very cold months, but the rest of the time not so much.
Yeah.
And
I wonder if it's also less cold.
Well, there is that possibility. So
solar.
All right, well, you know, we'll have to see if this works out.
I've heard people were getting increasingly enthusiastic about heat pumps. I also think that there's government subsidies for people to buy heat pumps.
Yes.
So
that's how they got things going in Maine.
Yeah.
So largely that.
Right. So you'd like to think there wouldn't be such a program unless there was a strongly held belief that they were more efficient.
Or just to move people away from or toward more sustainable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It reminds me of that TV show we're watching now. Occupied. David, I think you told us to watch it.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. You know, Norway developing greener power?
Yeah, Thorndom or something like that. It's very strange.
As opposed to the oil industry, getting out of the oil industry. Yeah. So anyway, that's Occupied. That's a fun show.
Yeah. All right, so this is very briefly. I talked just mentioning the fellow who started, Randy Sparks passed away. He started the New Christie Minstrels, which again, I don't expect Ellie to have ever heard the phrase in her life before. And she's saying she hasn't. So when Tams and I and Cindy and David were young, we were sitting around eating chocolate chip ice cream,
correct,
waiting on line for the bathroom. And we were listening to the new Christie Minstrels, or at least we were aware of it. I
wasn't. We were not really listening.
No, we weren't listening. No. But that's when they were popular.
That was the kind of group that would be on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Right.
Yeah.
Or something. Yeah. Well, they had dance routines, right?
They're very clean cut. They're like Up With People. You remember Up With People?
Yeah.
Well, Up With People, and I do recall this, you know, they just had Super Bowl, and they had who did the halftime show for Super Bowl?
Usher.
Yeah. Of course, Cindy's right on it. Usher, and I will say the first or second Super Bowl halftime was Up With People. I mean, that was the way the NFL wanted to be positioned and identified, with that kind of very clean-cut, folk-singy type approach.
What was this guy's name?
This guy was Randy Sparks. He started, but he distinguished himself for having a great eye for talent, not only in picking the minstrels, who were nine clean-cut young people, sang pretty well, but some other folks. And he, one of the first people he cultivated as a talent was a fellow singer-songwriter named Henry John Deutschendorf Jr. And he said he thought he was good, he'd take him on, but he had to change his name. So he changed his name to John Denver, and that worked out. He also, you know, he developed the Kenny Rogers, but the one that was most interesting, and we were just talking about it before, was he actually discovered a young Steve Martin. And Steve Martin, as some of you've seen in the late night shows, played the banjo. And that's how he got started in show business. He was playing the banjo, and he competed in a local talent show. And it was at the Knott's Berry Farm Amusement Park near L.A.
Well, that's a real thing. That's a big thing.
Arrow going through his head?
No. He's just playing the banjo, I think. You've heard of the Knott's Berry Amusement Park?
Oh, absolutely.
Talent show?
Yeah. Well, not the talent show, but the Knott's Berry Farm.
Yeah.
It was a real attraction.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, wasn't he doing magic shows?
Oh, well, but in this particular competition, he was just playing the banjo.
Okay.
And he came in second. He didn't come in first. But somehow Randy Sparks thought he had some talent. So he had a backup group to the new Christie Minstrels called the Back Porch Majority. Some of you may have heard of that or not. And one of its first members was Steve Martin. So anyway, he passed away. And the other large obituary in our last article was that Richard Lewis passed away, and the comedian. And I asked at the beginning if anyone, or in particular David, had strong views on Richard Lewis. And David, you turn out to be a Richard Lewis fan.
Absolutely. Podcast had not begun.
I'm sorry, go ahead. We missed
his explanation of why and how he was so paranoid that he had a rear view mirror on his stationary bike.
That's
Richard Lewis.
Yeah, that's a great line. I remember him talking about it. He was talking about dealing with his father, and his father would drive him crazy. And he says, my father's the kind of guy, we got in the car in New York, we're about to drive cross country. And as soon as I start the car, he's jangling coins in his pocket so the chains is ready for the Golden Gate Bridge. But yeah, Richard Lewis is pretty funny. All right, so...
Explain who he was.
Well,
he made, being neurotic New Yorker personality a funny thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
He there's no question he's an exemplar of that. He's the avatar of that. He's not the only one.
A little bit Lenny Brucey?
Yeah, a little bit Lenny Brucey. But I think Lenny Brucey really wasn't wearing his insecurities on his sleeve. He was more lashing out. Richard Lewis, as Tamsin put it, you know, his insecurities, his difficulties in dealing with things was kind of front and center. And what I learned when I read the obituary is that it wasn't for comic effect, that he really was that way. And he was, some people would describe him as depressed, seriously depressed. And it was all he could do sometimes to pull himself together to get on stage. So he wasn't ranting just for effect. He had a dark view of things.
Yeah, but it was interesting to me. We didn't have that in Maryland.
Well,
it was one of these, it was, you know, a picture of, you know, a different kind of person living up there in the New York area.
That's interesting. Yeah. I was going to say I knew a lot of people like that on the island.
Until I met you.
To me, I knew 1,000 people. All right. So that's a cultural difference then. And yet here we are still together celebrating your birthday.
Right.
How do you like that? Okay. So that, I think, pretty much winds it up for our annual, much anticipated Richmond, Virginia podcast.
Which we always love to do. We're glad that David managed to get through.
Yeah, but we're sorry that David,
even though he's calling from afar,
couldn't be here in person. We missed you at the restaurant last night, David. And as a result, there were people lined up at the restaurant who had no idea what to order when they came in because you weren't there. So we'll correct that next year.
Well, this is my opportunity. Order the chicken.
Okay.
All right.
So until next week.
This is Tamsin Granger.
And Dan Abuhoff.
And Cynthia Gompert.
Ellie Burke.
David Gompert.
Very good.
And
we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Ha ha ha.